So that's the interesting thing. There's two nomenclatures that we need to define in what your whistleblowers told you goes into his report. There's UAP, and that's grey. We just don't know at this moment. But alien reproduction vehicle, I can tell you, is very, very clearly a reference to a vehicle that has been constructed from non-human technology that is being operated presumably by either private aerospace or the United States government.
A male staff member in Congressman Brown's office not only confirmed the exhibit, but the fact that there were three discs at that exhibit. These discs were hovering off the floor without any visible means of support. They were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles, also nicknamed the Flux Liner because they used high voltage electricity.
This general got up and he was describing these vehicles. He described them as alien reproduction vehicles, ARV for short. They also had a nickname for the aircraft. They called them flux liners. Now, flux is an electrical term for a high electrical charge. So, high electrical charge liner, a flux liner.
Brad said that in this exhibit at Norton Air Force Base, that a three-star general said that these vehicles were capable of doing light speed or better.
In his groundbreaking article released in October of 2024, accomplished journalist Michael Schellenberger brought a new UAP whistleblower's testimony to the public zeitgeist. This whistleblower uncovered the shadowy Immaculate Constellation, an unacknowledged special access program that consolidates observations of UAP by both tasked and untasked collection platforms. The most groundbreaking aspect of this article to me was a single sentence mention of a term made famous by aerospace illustrator Mark McCandlish. Quote, "The report concludes that the existence of Immaculate Constellation demonstrates the extant capability to detect, quarantine, and transfer UAP and ARV, alien reproduction vehicle collection incidents before they are observed and circulated within the military intelligence enterprise," end quote. Many are familiar with the famous alien reproduction vehicles, also known as flux liners, described by McCandlish as relayed by Brad Sorensen, who allegedly witnessed these three saucer-shaped craft reverse-engineered from non-human intelligence technology at a classified air show near Norton Air Force Base in 1988. But what is the full story behind ARV? What is the origin of this term? And what stories can we explore to try and support or discredit Schellenberger's whistleblower? Why the conspiracies around Mark McCandlish and his 2014 documentary filmmaker James Allen's mysterious deaths? What can we learn from a truly consequential long-form interview primary witness Brad Sorensen gave in 1990, which I believe is the only time he ever spoke about the air show outside of conversations with McCandlish? And why did Brad Sorensen tell me that I was next if I investigated this story further? Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and thank you so very much for joining me as we investigate and take a deep dive into the subject of alien reproduction vehicles as relayed by Mark McCandlish. The concept of successfully reverse-engineered UFO has perplexed me for many years, and with the direct naming of ARV in the Immaculate Constellation article, I believe it is a perfect time to finally dive into this subject. Let us analyze the testimony of the now infamous Mark McCandlish and explore all avenues of the alien reproduction vehicle.
My name is Mark McCandlish, and for the better part of the last 30 years, I've been a conceptual artist, illustrator, and designer, working predominantly for the aerospace and defense industries. About 1988, I came into some information that indicated that the United States government was in possession of and operating a kind of anti-gravity technology through a system, an aircraft that was referred to as the Flux Liner or as the Alien Reproduction Vehicle.
The late Mark McCandlish served as a highly decorated aerospace and aeronautical illustrator who devoted his talents to detailing sketches of advanced military and corporate projects. Mark's client list was astounding, including the U.S. Air Force, Rockwell International, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, as well as respected publications, such as Aviation Week and Popular Science. Viewers of my channel may remember Mark for his appearance on Stephen Greer's 2001 National Press Club panel, where he discussed the line art design of the alien reproduction vehicle, aka Flux Liner. but few understand the full story and depth to which McCandlish explored these anomalous vehicles, a depth which very well may have seen Mark meet his demise. In the fall of 1988, McCandlish planned to attend an air show at Norton Air Force Base to network with military and government officials, as well as view new and innovative military aircraft with his good friend and fellow designer and inventor, Brad Sorensen. A short time before the show, on November 12, 1988, Mark regrettably dropped out to finish some lucrative design work for Popular Science and left Brad to attend the air show with a client of his. About a week after the show, Mark called his strangely absent friend. Brad sounded off. On the phone, absent was his often animated personality. Brad told Mark he had seen something he probably shouldn't have.
"How did you like the air show?" And he just seemed completely different. When I talked to him on the phone, he sounded almost depressed. I mean, it was kind of a strange sort of reaction. And he said, I don't know. I think I saw something I wasn't supposed to see. And I said, well, how's that possible? Everything that's at the air show is sent there and flown there with the intent of putting it on static display, especially for the public. So how could you possibly see something that wasn't intended to be seen? He says, I got in to see a display that was a little more exclusive.
Here is what Brad told Mark. Brad ultimately attended the air show with one of his clients described as a tall white man with glasses, an Italian-sounding name, wealthy, and a former Secretary of Defense or Undersecretary of Defense. Right around the time of the USAF Thunderbirds flyby at the air show, this individual issued Brad away from the main crowd. Mark initially assumed Brad and the man arrived to a hangar with four connected huts in the middle for this exhibit. But Brad would later disclose he, his client, amongst military personnel and dignitaries, boarded a military version of the Boeing 727 and flew north of Norton to Palmdale Air Force Plant 42.
Both military and civilian that got on a military version of the Boeing 727, and they flew from Norton Air Force Base up to Air Force Plant 42, which is in Palmdale. A lot of people just consider it the Palmdale Airport. It was actually a facility that was built, from what I understand, by Lockheed back in the 1960s. And the hangar that is now serving as a Skunk Works hangar was the original construction site for the L-1011 Lockheed Strike TriStar airliner.
Now remember Palmdale USAF Plant 42, as we will discuss this facility later. Among the personnel sent on the 727, according to Brad, were the late California Senator Alan Cranston and Congressman George E. Brown Jr., who was at the time serving as the chairman of the Congressional Committee of Space Science and Advanced Technology. Possibly our most key individual here is Brad's client, the tall Italian man who passed Brad off as his aide to board the flight to the special exhibit. Brad seemingly never gave this man's name, or to protect Brad, McCandlish never publicly confirmed this, but with high confidence, Mark reasoned this individual was Frank Carlucci, the 16th U.S. Secretary of Defense succeeded by Dick Cheney. Let's analyze Carlucci a little more. From 1992 to 2003, Carlucci served as chairman of the Carlyle Group, a private equity and asset management corporation with over $400 billion in assets, I highly suspect is deeply involved with UAP programs. Since its founding in 1987 under David Rubenstein, the Carlyle Group attracted myriad senior statesmen for advisors and board members, including Carlucci, George H.W. Bush, Secretary of State James Baker, and former UK Prime Minister John Major. The Carlyle Group served as pioneer investors in defense and national security, such as acquiring the electronics division of General Dynamics, investing in Northrop Grumman, and from 1999 to 2001 owned EG&G, the same company deeply entwined in UFO lore from the testimony of Bob Lazar to serving as the parking lot hosting the Wilson-Davis meeting. I would also like to draw your attention to Ronald Moultrie, former Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence and Security in the Biden administration. Along with his good friend Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, Moultrie served to spread disinformation by denying the existence of UAP at the 2022 UAP hearings. Moultrie, sometimes referred to as a gatekeeper of UAP programs, has some very strange ties to the Carlyle Group, such as serving as a board member in iCapital, a Carlyle-invested group, and serving on the board of directors for the Better Angels, funded by Carlyle's founder David Rubenstein. Carlyle Group is not the topic of our video today, but the ties here to Carlucci alongside his probable involvement in a classified airshow demonstrating ARV is of extreme interest. Walking into the Palmdale Hangar exhibit, Brad was told by his client, likely Carlucci, to keep his mouth shut and to not speak to anybody due to unexpected things at the show. The exhibit featured numerous high-tech aircraft, including the losing model from the B-2 stealth bomber competition and advanced hovercraft that employed hidden thrust mechanisms. The show also had the infamous Lockheed Pulsar, aka the Aurora craft. The Aurora, sometimes referred to as Astra, has often historically been associated with a triangular-shaped, possibly reverse-engineered craft. But in 1988, Brad relayed a much more grounded yet highly advanced design. The Lockheed Aurora was described as a large flattened-out football, all black and covered in tiles not too dissimilar to the space shuttle. Aurora featured a synthetic vision system utilizing infrared seeker heads. There was at the exhibit, however, a secondary model featuring a canopy cockpit and two vertical stabilizers. Brad described this craft as employing two unusual propulsion systems, engines in the fuselage and external pulse detonation engines, allowing the craft to fly 10 to 15,000 miles per hour. Mark would later state Tom Keaton from Lockheed Martin Calabasas Division confirmed the existence of the Aurora to him. Brad then described a massive black curtain separating the hangar into two distinct areas. Brad made his way to the second half of the exhibit.
And so this was, you know, so he got kind of scared. He stopped talking. And so I said, well, you know, let's have lunch. You know, he was nervous about talking about it on the phone. So I go over there and we start talking. And as he's describing this stuff, he's describing the different features that he'd seen. And well, how do you know that? I mean, if you could just look at the outside of the vehicle, how do you know what the inner workings is? He says, well, they had taken some of the panels off the outside so you could see the inside of, you know, what the components look like. And he said it was remarkably simple. There wasn't that much to it. And I said, you were able to figure out how it worked from that? He said, well, no, they had an easel next to it with a drawing, a cutaway drawing, that showed some of the internal components, how they were arranged with it, oriented to one another. And then they had a little a TV monitor with a tape player below it that was showing this, you know, continuous loop of this thing sitting, you know, or hovering over a, like a dry lake bed out in the desert somewhere, and as you would watch the tape, this thing would make went from a hovering position, made these three little sort of hops going to the side, and then as the camera followed it, it just went straight up and disappeared out of sight. Down to nothing in just a matter of a second and a half or so.
When meeting Mark for lunch the following week, Brad would sketch and discuss what he observed at this special exhibit. The exhibit was populated solely by top military brass and influential politicians, and was guarded by men in berets with M16 rifles. Displayed were three flying saucers hovering off the ground, ranging in diameter from 20 to 24 feet to 120 to 130 feet, but identical in scale. Brad described the craft to Mark as looking like they belonged in the 1950s, appearing like a jello mold on the bottom with sloping sides, a dome on top, and a door that looked at home on a submarine. A three-star general began to describe the vehicles to the attendees. The three saucers were called alien reproduction vehicles, nicknamed Flux Liners. Each of the three craft had panels removed for attendees to view the craft's interior, and alongside the speaker's podium sat an easel showing craft blueprints, as well as a video player showing film demonstrating the ARV's capabilities. As Mark described, the film showed the ARV hovering over a dry lake bed before it would make three quick hops and jettison into the sky at astounding speeds.
One of the things that this general had said during the presentation, one of the things that really stood out in Brad's mind was that he said that these vehicles were capable of light speed or better.
Faster than light speeds is truly an astounding claim, so let's try and analyze the ARV in greater detail. Fortunately, as a designer himself, Brad would describe the Flux Liners in extensive detail to Mark, allowing the talented artist to make up high-quality blueprints and line art of the craft. It is important to note the difference between the ARV and historical UAP testimony. In numerous UAP and UAP crash sightings, craft are often described as rivetless, seamless, with no visible means of propulsion, often with a description of the vehicle looking 3D printed. This was night and day different to the ARV. Sorensen described the ARV as extremely worn, appearing to have been operating for decades. Chips were rampant in the lead paint coating of the craft, which seemed to serve to protect the crew from X-ray radiation, and the entire craft featured numerous smudges and fingerprints. Each of the three ARVs featured a crew compartment. The smallest design displayed four ejection seats attached to a vertical beam in the middle of the craft. The pilot utilized a strange ball control scheme to operate the craft, which allocated power to various parts of the craft's propulsion mechanism we will talk about shortly. The ARV featured no windows for pilot visibility. Instead, each saucer dome was outfitted with an array of bumps housing optical camera equipment. This fitted the craft with a synthetic vision system.
This synthetic vision system uses the same kind of technology as the gun slaving system they have in the Apache helicopter, except in this case you have two cameras, and it picks any pair of the cameras in that pattern of six that are around the circumference, including the one on the top. Whichever pair most closely matches the orientation of the pilot's head. So if he wants to look behind him, he can pick a view in that direction. The cameras slew in pairs, and he has a little screen in front of his helmet, and it gives him an alternating view. He has a little set of glasses that he wears, and in fact you can actually buy a 3D viewing system for your video camera now that does this same thing. And what it does is it uses a beam splitter, which sends part of light one way and then part of it at a right angle and offsets it by about 6 inches. And then it has an electronic shutter in there that uses these a liquid crystal type material that darkens and becomes transparent at intervals of about 60th of a second or a 30th of a second. And so the cameras, as they're looking around, are giving him a right-left view. And the goggles, the things that he's wearing, he has two little projection screens inside his helmet. And they both project, well, two cameras, but one projection screen. And the glasses have that special blocking device that allows one eye to see and then the other eye to see, and at the same time the cameras are projecting right view left view, but they're doing it at like 30 frames a second. And so when he looks around, he has a perfect 3D view of the outside, but no windows.
The crew compartment or dome was completely separate from the propulsion system, and the propulsion system made no noise, featured no moving parts, and output no gases or exhaust. Interestingly, Brad would state many of the craft's components, including the crew jump seats and cameras, seemed similar to off-shelf components and not highly specialized for the ARV. Radial oxygen tanks, presumably for crew atmosphere, sat atop an enormous capacitor array, estimated by Mark to be roughly 14 inches thick. Curiously, a radial arm sat above the capacitor plates, featuring the ability to extend outside the body of the craft. Mark theorized the purpose of this arm was for sample collection. Mark questioned Brad if, due to the capacitor array, he thought this meant the craft functioned via the Byfield-Brown effect, which converts electrostatic energy into propulsion. To learn more about electrogravitics, and I feel like I've said this in the last 5 videos, I highly recommend watching Jesse Michael's video on T. Townsend Brown, and please note, I recently theorized Edwards Air Force Base, which is very close to USAF Plant 42 and Norton, engages in a reverse engineering ARV testing program. Historically, Edwards placed very heavy importance in alternative propulsion methods such as the Byfield-Brown effect. I highly recommend watching this video, as over the course of this ARV exploration, we will further discuss ties to Edwards. Brad stated perhaps the Byfield-Brown effect had some sort of application here, but the ARV were in fact utilizing energy drawn from quantum fluctuations, aka zero-point energy. This again calls back to the witness Ed I covered in my video on reverse engineering at Edwards Air Force Base, who commented on the existence of zero-point systems.
There is a scientist in Utah by the name of Morey B. King. He's written a book called Tapping the Zero-Point Energy, and what he maintains is that this energy is embedded in space-time all around us. It's in everything we see. I think it was, James Clerk Maxwell speculated that there's enough of this flux, this electrical charge in the nothingness of space, that if you could capture all the energy that was embedded in just a cubic yard of space, that you'd have enough energy to boil the oceans of the entire world. That's how much energy is sitting there waiting to be tapped.
Before we continue with Mark's investigation, let's take a moment to recognize Mark is relaying secondhand information up to now on ARV. Why should we take him at his word, and do we have comment from Mr. Sorensen? Due to not having journalistic discretion, Mark historically regretted introducing Brad's full name into the story.
And I had a colleague, a friend, who I'll just call Brad for the sake of this discussion. Some people know what his last name is, and I've tried to discontinue using his name, principally because disclosing of his name has brought a lot of unwanted attention to him and his career. I don't know specifically what, if any, or how much harm has come to him in terms of his career because of my disclosures. I have to say that not being a journalist, not having a background in journalism, I didn't really know when I was being prodded by people in the Disclosure Project to name names and things like that, which I did, this could be potentially and very harmful to the individuals who had been the original source of the material. In the case of Brad and another individual who had had occasion to see one of these things up close when he was actually in the service in 1973 at Edwards Air Force Base, there were a lot of details that were not only seen by these individuals, but were also explained to them, basically to understand what they were looking at.
Brad has been strangely radio silent on Mark and the story of ARV. Well, of course, I got in contact with Brad. Interactions with him from the get-go were extremely hostile. I was told, quote, Mark McCandlish was a stupid, dramatic, selfish fool who died because he could not keep his mouth shut. Learn from this, end quote. This statement is in relation to Mark's strange and controversial 2021 passing, allegedly resulting from a self-inflicted gunshot wound we will revisit later. But Brad's words directly imply Mark's words got him killed. Further interactions with Brad would lead to him saying, I cannot cover this topic without facing mortal peril, and to say goodbye to everyone I love if I continue to investigate Mark and the subject of ARV. I was even told I would never see it coming. My most interesting interaction with Brad stemmed from asking why Mark was allowed to talk openly about this topic for 20 years. I was told Brad protected Mark until he could not. We will discuss this further later. Hostile and silent, Brad has historically refused to comment on this case. But for this investigation, I have uncovered some documents I have never before seen discussed in the public domain. In December of 1990, 2 years after Mark and Brad met to discuss the Fluxliner, Mark relayed the contents of the restricted airshow to William B. Scott, senior engineering editor of Aviation Week and Space Technology. Bill would feature some of Mark's sketches on the Pulse Detonation Aurora craft on the respected magazine and reach out to Brad for comment on the experimental aircraft and more strange craft, as some of the craft Mark described matched eyewitness accounts relayed to the prestigious magazine over the years. Around this time, Brad went silent, even secluding himself to Mark, but not before Bill Scott was able to interview Brad on December 3rd, 1990. Let's dive into this interview I have never once before seen discussed. Brad stated he was not officially invited to the hangar in which the strange aircraft exhibit was stored. He was, as Mark stated, passed off as an aide for a gentleman who served within the Carter administration. Seeing as Frank Carlucci was deputy director of the CIA for Carter, he may still serve as a logical choice here. But why did Brad take this interview? Well, as he stated, quote, because I love America and the whole nine yards, but I'm also a Democrat, and I don't think we need this type of spending on military equipment. It's just nuts. And that's what the whole meeting was for. Appropriations of billions of dollars to develop new craft, end quote. Very interesting statement. The 30 or so individuals present here were to be shown prototype and craft functionality to attract investors to these black budget projects. Brad described blue fatigued and suit clad men conducting the briefings at the special air show with exotic yet prosaic craft on display. Quote, diff in each area, like a specialist in each area, some wearing suits, some wearing military, like Air Force, colonel, major, something like that. I did not see any stars in there, like generals of any sort. If there had, I would have noticed that, end quote. Bill and Brad discuss some of the VTOL, vertical takeoff and landing craft at the show, and the utilization of depleted uranium shells. Brad even noticed the V-22 Osprey was present, whose first official flight was conducted in 1989. The witness also confirmed the presence of California State Senator Alan Cranston. The rest of the crowd all appeared to be senior individuals, 45 to 60 years old. No support staff or aides surrounded what Brad referred to as the people. This section of the exhibit was likened to the hangar deck of an aircraft carrier with tightly packed craft. Most of the craft appeared to Brad as one-off prototypes. One of the enclosures featured the losing B-2 bomber prototypes, just as Mark would later state. Brad also confirmed the unmanned, elongated, football-shaped Aurora craft that looked extremely similar to Mark's sketches but with a more tapered back. The craft was enormous, almost 100 to 110 feet in length. The dual propulsion system of the Aurora was also confirmed. Internal fuselage engines were utilized to get up into the air. Then pulse detonation engines were used to accelerate the craft to truly incredible speeds, 6 to 8 Mach, which is why the craft was unmanned. The present officials were extremely proud of the Aurora craft, stating, quote, "Within an hour and 20 minutes, they could take out every city over a million in the Soviet Union," end quote. Bill Scott asked if the Aurora was the most exotic thing on display. Brad responded with a resounding 3 no's. Brad would then state Mark's ARV drawing was so GD accurate, there was little he could further specify about the craft. When Brad first witnessed the alien reproduction vehicles, he was reminded of a nursery rhyme, labeling the craft Daddy, Mommy, and Baby Bear, as the craft seemed identically crafted to the same proportions but in different sizes. The smallest was roughly 20 feet in diameter, medium 60 feet, and largest 120 feet in diameter. Brad stated he thought the craft were very poorly built compared to the other craft on display. Quote, "They had been built by scientists who didn't know a hell of a lot about laying up composite materials or whatever," end quote. The crew compartment sphere appeared to have messy filaments for the sole purpose of holding in pressure. The entire craft was coated with a thick, heavy lead paint. Brad confirmed the ARVs were hovering, not connected to the floor. Brad was told the three craft didn't need a fuel source. They had found a new fuel source that was everywhere in the universe, on the order of 500 times the speed of light, allowing the craft to travel 5 to 8 times the speed of light. Brad would dive into the gravity manipulation propulsion system, which Mark would later on discuss further. The craft was able to output 10 to the 26 power joules per cubic meter of space. Utilizing the synthetic vision system and pilot control ball, the vehicle was able to allocate power from the capacitor plates to travel to very different destinations. All with the ability to withstand 85 Gs of acceleration, the local area around the craft was not subject to inertial forces. Mark will expand on this later on. Curiously to Brad, the craft didn't feature food or long-term provisions, nor were any compasses or navigational charts present. Drawings, diagrams, and videotapes showed the craft flying in jerky, serrated, up-and-down patterns before jettisoning out of sight. The craft did not appear to involve normal aerodynamic principles. The exhibit attendees were told there were only 3 craft in existence, quote, "You can take this how you want to. We took all of it with a grain of salt, but..." The guy said that with this group of craft that, they had been everywhere in the solar system, and there's no life, end quote. I must make a correction here, as initially Brad said no life in the universe, but he corrected this to mean solar system. The men running the ARV exhibit claimed they copied the concepts of the vehicle. Bill asked if the non-uniformed man answering audience questions discussed what the vehicles had been produced from. Quote, "Well, they tried to avoid it. They said something about 1947. They had some sort of a contact, telling them that we had no right to use nuclear weapons, okay? That it was more disturbed than we knew. Cease and desist," end quote. Brad would then give, in my opinion, the most interesting statement of this entire interview.
"And all they really needed to do was give us the truth, and we would either take it or leave it. They just said that they had come across some hardware, tried to make contact with these. The others didn't want to make contact. They just wanted to deliver the news and leave, okay? But back in 1947, we had just won the war. We felt pretty damned cavalier, and we attacked, basically, okay? Rather than fighting back, they just tried to destroy all of their stuff and get away. And they didn't get all of it destroyed. That's what they said. also said they couldn't really make those things that they found work, that they had to build their own, that this was built for our consumption, not theirs. Theirs was the wrong scale and the wrong, you know, whatever. Bill says, so we just looked at theirs and built our own? Brad responds, uh-huh, based on what was seen. So it was not like a great R&D breakthrough. It was just copying something that they had seen to the best of their abilities.
I need to take a moment to stress just how important this interview with Brad Sorensen and Bill Scott is. Quite often you will see individuals criticize Mark McCandless's story because they claim he is relaying secondhand information. As we saw in this interview, which I have never seen once discussed before, Brad confirmed not only the air show, not only the Aurora, not only the B-2 losing competitor and the stealth bomber prototypes, but also the ARV craft as saucers with faster-than-light speed capabilities. This is massive to see this in Brad's own words. Why did Bill Scott and Aviation Week and Space Technology never publish this segment? Well, it makes sense, as we saw in the document where Bill states that he had trouble believing some of the things Brad said because it had to do with flying saucers that were capable of light speed that were copied from other beings and technology dating back to 1947. Just wanted to take a minute to say that if you want to read the entire interview, I highly suggest it because I just did a summary here. The entire thing is quite mind-boggling. Back to the investigation. Was the ARV technology copied from the 1947 Roswell craft? The crudeness of the craft makes logical sense when in context scientists and engineers couldn't make the found anomalous craft work. The men spearheading the ARV program wished to build a fleet of these craft, but sought appropriate funding for it, hoping the Bush administration would be as enthusiastic as the Reagan administration about building up these reproduction vehicles. Never was it revealed who these vehicles belonged to, or who these men reported to. Wow, guys, so 11 years before Mark appeared on the Disclosure Project making the term ARV famous, Brad had actually confirmed the story all the way back in 1990. Included in these interview notes is a sketch of the exhibit which I believe was drawn by Sorensen's hand. Let's circle back to Mark and dive into his investigation around the ARV. After listening intently to Sorensen and analyzing the rough sketches of the ARVs Brad drew on some legal paper, Mark got to work utilizing his legendary drawing skills to translate the ARV to traditional blueprint designs. Mark's work ultimately led to the now famous ARV Fluxliner cutaway drawing.
One of the original blueprints of the alien reproduction vehicle, which I produced in March of 1989, it was put together by accumulating a lot of verbal testimony from Brad and later from a number of other sources, including Ken Sellen and some other people that I talked to who had some contact or information about the vehicle.
In this clip, we heard Mark mention, alongside Sorensen, his design was based on the testimony of others who had seen the craft. In 2001, McCandless would feature in Stephen Greer's National Press Club conference with his explosive testimony, as well as a Stephen Greer interview titled Blueprint for a UFO, where he would expand on additional sightings of ARV.
Later, spoke to a gentleman by the name of Kent Sellen that I met at an air show at Edwards Air Force Base in 1992, the first unveiling publicly of the B-2 bomber. He indicated to me that in 1973, when he was a crew chief working on experimental aircraft at Edwards Air Force Base, that he had unintentionally wandered into an area where there was a classified aircraft, namely the ARV. He described it in detail, and he added other details to the account concerning the configuration and the operation of the vehicle that Brad Sorensen was not aware of.
According to Sellen, while working for the Air Intelligence Agency at Edwards North Base, he witnessed the Fluxliner ARV in 1973, when cutting across the base to retrieve a ground power unit. Sightings of ARV at Edwards are possibly corroborated within the long-lost files of Leonard Stringfield. In crash retrievals of the third kind, fantastic CAD designer Michael Schratt gained access to the files of the late Stringfield in MUFON, Ohio. Here, Schratt would publish cases that had not made their way into the crash retrieval status reports 1 through 7. Leonard received information from a Class A witness who claimed to have witnessed a captured UFO at Edwards. This pilot was given permission to cut across the base in a USAF security vehicle when he stopped at a group of hangars to ask for directions. Within the open hangars, the witness observed a large, disc-shaped craft with a clear, transparent dome on the top. The witness was immediately told to vacate the area. The incident allegedly took place in the 1960s. Similar instances exist in the files of Stringfield, such as the testimony of one Mr. Hines, who relayed secondhand info from a source at Bell Labs. In the early 1950s, this source saw a UFO retrieval or test craft being brought into a California airbase. The source additionally saw a cutaway of the craft. The fantastic 2014 documentary we've been pulling clips from, titled Zero Point, The Story of Mark McCandlish and the Flux Liner, explores an additional witness who claimed to have knowledge of the ARV, one Lieutenant Colonel John Williams. Williams' 2000 testimony also features briefly in Stephen Greer's fantastic disclosure briefing document. Williams served as an electrical engineer in charge of construction projects for Military Air Command at Norton from 1981 to 1982. The Lieutenant Colonel stated he knew of a facility within Norton Air Force Base that was so secretive not even the base's wing commander was allowed access. Rumors circulated the base facility housed a UFO. Very little more than rumors here in Williams' story, however, even the implication of a craft near Norton is worthy to analyze. Mark's pursuit of tracking down other witnesses of ARV was relentless. In 2001, on the Disclosure Project conference panel, Mark would display two original photographs obtained from USAF Captain Harvey Williams, who photographed a disc in 1967 while flying a C-47 at 12,000 feet over Provo, Utah. Mark would state the images accurately depict the ARV craft up to the synthetic vision systems on the crew component of the craft. Mark utilized these photographs to highlight how the synthetic vision system may have changed from 1967 to 1988. As mentioned before, many components of the 1988 ARV as relayed by Brad utilized off-shelf components, including the synthetic vision systems and surrounding acrylic bubble. Mark reasoned due to cameras being much larger in 1967, the vision system bubbles would need to be much larger as well to accommodate these devices. Interesting to analyze this possible ARV evolution.
Later on, I obtained photographs that were taken in 1967 by a military pilot, Harvey Williams, flying a C-47 for the Air Force at 12,000 feet, approximately 25 miles southwest of Provo, Utah. This particular vehicle matches the so-called ARV in all proportions and respects in terms of the detail of the shape of the craft.
I would like to quickly highlight Provo, Utah is under 100 miles from Dugway Proving Grounds, a location I have covered previously. Witness MS claimed to have observed a hovering craft at the Dugway Aviary Building and also knew of a dome, a deep underground military base engaging in UAP programs under Dugway's main facility. From 1988 to his passing in 2021, Mark's insatiable curiosity would lead him to devoting much of his life to discovering how the ARV functioned. He would draw parallels to possible Nazi flying saucer technology and Die Glock, patents filed by associates of T. Townsend Brown, and even technology possibly discovered by the great Nikola Tesla. Mark's research led him to hypothesize an elegantly simple yet crude design.
The ARV system, for all of its claims of flashy, out-of-this-world propulsion capabilities, was indeed remarkably simple. It could be described as a large-scale, souped-up Tesla coil designed to negate gravity and inertia, with off-the-shelf navigation and life support systems bolted on, almost as an afterthought. You could think of it as the Model T of anti-gravity vehicles, an industrial dune buggy, or crude hot rod that can get you to Mars in a few minutes. In this version at least, first-class seating was still a way off.
The most complicated aspect of the ARV to Mark seemed to be the pilot's control system.
The sphere itself appears to be kind of a domed arrangement where you have a number of fiber optic leads that come into the sphere, and for each one of the 48 capacitor arrays, there's a series of sensors that are then used to sort of relay information to the individual plates. And so then, on the bottom of this, you have a bowl that moves around and can be used to convey the commands of the pilot in terms of what he wants to do in terms of shaping the field around the vehicle. And right in the center of that bowl is a kind of laser diode that sends a laser beam up into the underside, the inside of this sphere. And so as the bowl moves, that laser is sort of scanning around on the inside of the different sensors that are responsible for each of the capacitor sections. Then will, there's a series of relays that will open up and close and let a certain amount of energy in or, prevent it from going in. And when it's dead center, it means that all of them get the exact same amount of information. You just go straight up. If you want to bank to the right, then you you bank this to the right. It sends the laser signal over to the opposite side of the dome, and it says that the opposite side of the craft is going to get more energy, so it banks in that direction. It's kind of like in a helicopter, in the swash plate of a helicopter. When you want to bank to the left, you create more deflection in the main rotor on the right side so that it begins to bank to the right, or bank to the left, excuse me. So it's kind of the same principle.
Mark theorized the craft operated in space-time similar to an Alcubierre drive, a system that compresses space-time ahead of a craft and stretches space-time behind a craft. The area between these two vectors creates a localized space-time, reducing inertial effects and mitigating g-forces for the craft. The Alcubierre drive allows for a faster-than-light travel system, however. The validity of this drive has been debated endlessly, and I simply do not have the physics capabilities to contribute to this argument. This mitigation of G-forces and inertial dampening seems to be present in numerous historical UAP sightings where instantaneous acceleration is observed. Perhaps a localized space-time pocket is indeed possible with NHI and ARV craft, and I'd like to leave you with some words by former Northrop Grumman Deputy CTO and Colonel of Army Futures Command Carl Nell.
The second point is faster than light travel. Everybody says faster than light travel is not possible. This is false. Miguel Alcubierre, a postgraduate student at the University of Mexico in 1994, solved Einstein's equations for an effective faster-than-light mechanism. NASA has investigated this. Everyone accepts his solution is valid.
These performance characteristics draw my attention to estimating flight characteristics of anomalous unidentified aerial vehicles by Professor Kevin Knuth. In this paper, PhD Professor Knuth estimated the G-forces experienced by the Tic Tac craft in Commander David Fravor's 2004 sighting. G-forces experienced by this craft when it dropped from a high altitude to sea level were estimated to reach in excess of 5,500 Gs, for reference. Our best ballistic missiles can experience but a fraction of these G-forces before ripping themselves to shreds. Mark's research would ultimately lead to a 2015 lecture at the Secret Space Program titled The Feasibility of Interstellar Travel. The summary of this discussion states, quote, how back-engineered off-world technology created powerful leverage for corporations to take over control of world government, establish an internationally manned secret space program, and break away civilization, end quote. Even though firsthand witness Brad Sorensen stated the enigmatic men showing off the ARV claimed the craft had explored our solar system, this is a very charged statement by Mark. Oftentimes, the phrase secret space program is associated with unexplained claims and outright bizarre stories. So let's instead analyze the claims of Gary McKinnon and Edgar Fausch in relation to a secret space program. I have spoken about USAF Master Sergeant Edgar Fausch myriad times, most recently analyzing his claims of encountering full anti-gravity propulsion systems for a secret space fleet while working for the proposed Defense Advanced Research Center in 1979. Fausch claimed triangular-shaped craft titled TR-3B leveraged reverse-engineered technology to provide logistics and transportation to a secret space fleet. Construction of these craft are allegedly a joint effort by Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Teledyne, and the project is managed by the NRO, CIA, and NSA. Fausch's testimony is extremely impactful for me due to stating pilots of the TR-3B craft are few and far between. These elite pilots are plucked from the Edwards 412th Test Group Test Pilot School. I recently did a whole investigation into this subject, and with high confidence in this project's validity, I explored a joint research project between Edwards Air Force Base and Nellis Air Force Base focused on testing reverse-engineered craft and technology of non-human origin. This project I explored employs contractors such as Lockheed Martin and Boeing, skims funds off the F-35 fighter program, operates over restricted airspace such as the Nevada Test and Training Range, and employs the Edwards 412 Test Pilot School and Electronics Warfare Group. Have no fears that TR-3B will get a full exploration of its own, but context around Mark's discussion on a secret space program is extremely valuable here. Additionally, remember if you will, U.S. Army Green Beret RA, who witnessed the Off-World Technologies Division at the Naval Surface Warfare Center in Crane, Indiana. RA stated in an interview to me while performing operations on Nellis and nearby DOE-owned land, he was witness to triangular-shaped craft operating off electrogravitic propulsion. In 2002, British hacker Gary McKinnon was arrested for hacking into U.S. Army and NASA computer systems. McKinnon claimed amongst mundane files was an image housed in the NASA Johnson Space Center featuring a cigar-shaped object stationed in near-Earth orbit. McKinnon also claimed to have found a document on a NASA server titled Non-Terrestrial Officers, containing names and ranks of USAF personnel. Amongst these documents were tabs for material transfer between ships. This already draws parallels to Fauch's TR-3B logistics and personnel carrier ships. So maybe this idea of a black budget hidden space program isn't so fantastical. Let's see what Mark has to say in this discussion.
I want to talk to you about a few of the different vehicles that I believe are being used in the secret space program or have been used in the secret space program.
Craft listed here are of course the Fluxliner Alien Reproduction Vehicle, as well as the first generation Aurora constructed by Lockheed, and a triangular shaped craft out of Lockheed Skunk Works that allegedly served as the target for a 1989 Germany crash retrieval operation. McCandlish detailed how his first suspicions of highly classified black budget aircraft programs arose when he met two Lockheed Skunk Works personnel who commissioned Mark to illustrate a pitch to DoD for a new jet with extreme speed capabilities. Mark compared components of scramjet technology to create what he thought was an extremely eye-catching design. Meeting with these Skunk Works personnel, they grew furious with Mark, accidentally letting it slip aircraft components would tear apart during Mach 17 speeds or 13,000 miles per hour. And remember, this was before Lockheed became Lockheed Martin, so this incident occurred even before the Sorensen ARV incident. For reference, the world's fastest jet, the unmanned NASA X-43, reaches a top speed of Mach 9.6 or 7,366 miles per hour. And the world's fastest manned jet, the SR-71 Blackbird, reached solely Mach 3.3 or 2,193 miles per hour. Mark moved on to discuss in great detail Sorensen's ARV experience in 1988. Not a ton of new information here we haven't already covered. Mark did touch on the interesting point that Brad and most likely Frank Carlucci flew a short flight to Palmdale Air Force Plant 42 to view this special exhibit.
As they were going into the hangar, the gentleman turns to my friend and says, he just realized that there are some aircraft on exhibit here that you're not cleared for, to security-wise. You are not cleared to see these aircraft. So just enjoy the show, walk around, you know, listen, take a look, but don't say anything to anybody. So he goes in. I don't know how well you can see this because it came out kind of light, but there were two pieces or two sections to this particular hangar on the inside.
I would like to add, Air Force Plant 42 in Palmdale is less than 30 miles southwest of Edwards Air Force Base. The site features a sizable Northrop Grumman facility as well as Lockheed Martin hangars and the home of the infamous Lockheed Martin Skunk Works Division. The claim these ARVs were shown at Plant 42 very near Edwards matches very closely with my previous thesis of a joint reverse engineering program out of Edwards. Now, Witness Ed stated he worked on joint programs with Lockheed Martin and Boeing, yet historically, Northrop has been additionally implicated in the construction of the TR-3B Black Manta craft and an anti-gravity disc known as the Great Pumpkin developed at Northrop Grumman Advanced Concepts and Technologies Division, Palmdale, California. Hang tight, guys, because our next project will cover U.S. aerospace craft allegedly built with NHI technology, especially because there are numerous claims of joint-developed reverse-engineered craft from Lockheed Skunk Works and Northrop Grumman. All of these deviations from Mark's story are to say I find the continued parallels between the Alien Reproduction Vehicle and the 412th Reverse Engineering Group at Edwards and Nellis quite tangible, as well as the addition of Northrop Grumman to the core contractors engaging in ARV. Mark leveraged his understanding of physics to discuss how the ARV craft possibly generated three different electromagnetic fields. One created by the primary windings of the Tesla coil, one created by the windings in the center, and finally one created by a low-temperature plasma fired through the center. And guys, I say this all the time, physics really isn't my strong suit, so please watch the lecture for a better understanding.
So in the process, what I really think that I've sort of stumbled across is a way in which this system here has three different electromagnetic fields. It has the one created by the primary windings of the Tesla coil. It has the windings in the center that also creates their electromagnetic field. But then when that plasma ring, or I should say is actually a low-temperature plasma-like phenomenon or a virtual plasma, it fires down through the center, and it also creates its own set of electromagnetic field lines. And so what happens is you have an effect that's very similar to, you've heard of the electromagnetic pulse that occurs when a nuclear bomb goes off. Well, they actually have a weapon. It's called the explosively pumped electromagnetic pulse weapon. And it does the same thing. And what it does, it just combines overlapping electromagnetic field lines, and then using explosives, it pinches pinches all those magnetic field lines, and it creates a powerful pulse. And so what I'm suggesting to you is that process is actually forms a kind of a doorway for tapping into the zero-point energy. Now, why is that significant? Why does that mean anything? Well, part of the reason is that this device, when it taps into zero-point energy, they've shown that zero-point energy is actually responsible for the effect of gravity, for inertia, and for mass. And so if you're pulling some of that energy out of the environment, it may be, even though there's an infinite amount, I mean, some of the latest figures are 10 to the 109th power joules per cubic centimeter. That's one of the latest figures I've seen. That's a monstrous amount of energy. That's enough energy that if you took all of the energy that's in this amount of space-time and were able to tap it, it would be able to boil off the oceans of the entire planet. So you can see how this technology makes a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. That's probably one of the reasons why there's such a tremendous effort to suppress it, because in the wrong hands, obviously, it could be weaponized and be very dangerous. Now, for example, Einstein said you can never travel faster than the speed of light because as you accelerate through space-time, your interaction with the zero-point energy that's embedded in space-time raises your mass, and so it makes it harder and harder for you to go faster and faster, so you can never really reach the speed of light. In fact, he said that as you approach the speed of light, that your mass would become near infinite. So imagine then that you're actually using the free energy of zero-point energy. You're tapping that as your propulsive force. You're using it in the environment. So there's a couple things that might happen when you do this. One is that it reduces the mass of your vehicle because you're using the stuff that would otherwise create to its increase. And you're using that to do work. You're using it as a propulsive force. So under that theory, you could actually be able to accelerate up to and beyond the speed of light because the very energy that would be ordinarily slowing you down by raising your mass is actually what you're using to push you along.
I do find it very interesting, since 1975, Los Alamos National Labs was conducting extensive research into these explosive magnetic flux compression generators. Mark would then highlight a Polaroid image taken north of Cedarville, California in the spring of 1984, which he purported may be one of the only photographs in existence of a string of vehicles used in this secret space program. Mark even illustrated the craft based on the eyewitness's testimony.
Now, under a loop looking at the original Polaroid, you can actually see a little bit more detail. This was a drawing done by the eyewitness, the fellow who took the photograph. And there were some things about it that I could probably go into, but the thing that's important to remember is that some of the features look remarkably like some of the structure on the so-called alien reproduction vehicle. And in fact, it did seem apparent to him that these wingtips, if you want to call them that, could actually rotate inward so that this thing would actually become more of a triangular shape, which also, of course, would help with issues like storage. Now, this is a little bit more detailed drawing that I did based on what I could see through the loop.
Near the end of the presentation, Mark circled back to the May 1989 East Germany crash recovery of a Lockheed Martin advanced aerospace vehicle. This craft recovery is claimed to have been executed by special forces, ringing parallels to the numerous claims of JSOC units involved in foreign and domestic UAP crash retrieval operations. Mark likened this craft to the F-117A stealth fighter utilizing stealth technologies. The most interesting component of this craft were the three spheres on the underside of the craft appearing to be made of a white superconducting ceramic material. The crash of this vehicle allegedly broke off the tail section, dislodging one of these spheres. The pilot involved with the crash told Mark the retrieval team was ordered not to touch the sparking sphere with bare hands. Mark theorized these spheres utilized some sort of cryogenic fluid to harness zero-point energy systems, meaning the craft may have employed ARV systems.
When I finally did get around to making a copy of this original drawing in the form of blueprint, I sent a copy to Brad. And one of the first things that he said to me on the phone was, and he wasn't kidding when he said this. He said, "You know, Mark," he says, "this drawing is about as accurate as you can get." He says, "Every detail, every aspect of it is right on the money." He said, "It is so accurate in every way." He says, "This has to be probably one of the most dangerous illustrations you've ever done in your life." And he says, "And if you're smart," he says, "you'll tear up the original, you'll throw it away, and you'll never talk about it again."
After Mark appeared on the 2001 Disclosure Project speaking openly to the world about the alien reproduction vehicle, he got the strange feeling his activities were being monitored. Mark was called and warned to stop doing what he was doing, and one by one he lost all of his defense clients. Mark reasoned he understood why some corporations and individuals may not have wanted to be associated with somebody speaking about flying saucers. Further attacks would see Mark threatened on the phone and his money and cars taken by the IRS. Mark would carry a heavy feeling of guilt and regret, including Brad Sorensen's name, stating he was almost coerced by Dr. Greer not to protect names.
I mean, there's many times I lay awake at night with my 9mm under my pillow, loaded, and I wonder why they haven't killed me. You know, I honestly do.
As we discussed earlier, I have played many clips from the fantastic documentary Zero Point, The Story of Mark McCandlish and the Fluxliner by the late filmmaker James Allen. This documentary discusses strange deaths of free energy pioneers such as fundamental physicist Stefan Marinov, who fell out of a window in 1997, cold fusion researcher Eugene Malove, who was beaten to death in 2004, Zero Point field investor Ari DeGuse, who was found dead in his car in 2007, and Star Drive inventor Mark Tomion, who died unexpectedly in 2009 after a successful demonstration of his prototype. The best example here is the case of Amy Eskridge, which I may save for a future full investigation. Dr. Amy Eskridge was a 35-year-old scientist and co-founder of the Institute for Exotic Science in Huntsville, Alabama. In 2022, Amy died in what was ruled a self-inflicted instance. However, an incredible amount of controversy surrounds her passing. Leading up to her death, Amy had been lecturing on behalf of Holocron Engineering, a gravity modification R&D company, discussing historical anti-gravity experiments and modern black projects associated with developing the anti-gravity TR-3B craft. Again, we'll save this for another time. Mark admitted he had no idea what the ARV and these technologies were used for, but he did state clandestine military operations may stop at nothing to prevent these technologies from leaking to the public and foreign adversaries, and housing these programs alongside defense contractors would strengthen classification of programs utilizing these systems. And these strange deaths very well may include James Allen of the 2014 documentary. The details around his death are highly suspicious.
This is the young man who produced the film that you'll probably have a chance to see later on, James Allen. He's passed away now. And this was literally just a month before the film was to be released. And he suddenly became very sick, was in the hospital. He died within 2.5 months. And the manner of his illness was so peculiar and so strange, we decided to go have some pathology done. And what we found, it's really hard to see on this chart because it's so small. I wish I could blow it up somehow. But basically, all of these little things here, we see an H next to those levels right there. Those are all radioisotopes like uranium, thorium, beryllium, cadmium. Things that you would not find naturally occurring. So it seems apparent to us that he was poisoned using radioisotopes. And so I would like to dedicate the memory or I'd like to dedicate this presentation to the memory of my friend James Allen. He's a brilliant young man, had a great potential as a filmmaker ahead of him, and I thank him for the time that he dedicated to documenting what I did.
On April 13th, 2021, at the age of 69, Mark was found dead in his home from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. That day of April 13th, Mark had spoken to his friend Rick Price and told him he would call him later. Mark additionally spoke to his girlfriend and told her he would speak to her when he arrived to work at her animal shelter. According to Robert D. Morningstar, Mark was supposed to testify to elements of the Senate on UAP in June of 2021 and had been in contact with Senator Rubio. Was Mark's death truly his choice? I am reminded of what Brad told me when I asked about Mark's death. Quote, Mark McCandlish was a stupid, dramatic, selfish fool who died because he could not keep his mouth shut. Learn from this, end quote. Why was Mark allowed to investigate and speak on the ARV from 1988 to 2021? Was testifying to the Senate, possibly including Rubio and the Gang of Eight, the final straw? I am again reminded of Brad's words, quote, I protected him until I could not, end quote. Hey guys, I know we ended on a very somber tone, so I would just like to take a moment to dedicate this video to the memory of James Allen and Mark McCandlish. Without Mark's work and James Allen's work, none of this would have been possible. I'd also highly recommend watching the 2004 documentary, Zero Point, and the story of the Fluxliner, as well as Stephen Greer's 2001 NPC and the interview with Mark titled Blueprint for a UFO. If you didn't notice earlier, I would also highly recommend reading the 1990 interview with Bill Scott, the senior engineer of Aviation Week and Space Technology, and Brad Sorensen. Now, after that massive investigation, what do you guys think? I personally find the story of the ARV one of, if the not most interesting stories in all of, whatever you want to call it, ufology. Even before the Schellenberger article with Immaculate Constellation and the mention of ARV, there was something about the McCandlish story that always stuck out to me. The level of detail with which he described the Fluxliner as relayed by Brad. And now after finding this interview with Brad, some of these small intricacies that Mark would say, this is how Brad acted. You know, usually he was very animated and quite, you know, lively. And then in the interview with Bill Scott, we see, you know, Brad using foul language and being very descriptive. I took special note of him kind of making fun of the designers of the ARV craft, saying clearly this was made by scientists. You know, Brad as an industrial designer and Mark as a designer, they carry a certain swagger with their design, sleek, beautiful, you know, especially Brad as coming from a car designer background, him just making fun of these scientists, saying it was clearly made by them. Now, I think the most shocking part of Brad's testimony in the 1990 interview is the statement of how these individuals in charge of the ARV got their hands on the craft, copied the technology, couldn't figure out how it worked from somewhere in 1947 with others, with beings that tried to take their technology off the board for humans. It wasn't meant for us. This harkens back to many stories in ufology about the Roswell craft, about humans getting their hands on technology forcefully, and stories in the private sector about companies and scientists not necessarily knowing how exactly these craft function. And thus we get a poor man's copy in the ARV. You know, we have these off-shelf components, the synthetic vision system, the jump seat, the radial oxygen tanks. It's quite interesting. And I also found it quite puzzling how Brad says he doesn't know who these craft belong to or what exactly they're for and report to. You know, part of me thinks they wondering about this secret space program, the craft, as Mark described, as possibly taking samples, if for these kind of black budget operations, which may function in sort of a closed loop. You know, there are stories of these places, facilities, programs operating in cash transactions and utilizing analog computers to completely stay off the books. It, you know, one would must think, how do these programs get their hands on materials, raw materials, metals, composite materials, you know, rare earth elements, lithium? You know, this begs the question, what if these ARV craft, what if one of their primary responsibilities is to, you know, visit the asteroid belt or near earth objects and kind of retrieve metals, precious metals, for these programs to operate and continue their research and continue their development. I'm just spitballing here. Of course, the reality is probably much stranger, especially when we factor in stories to Edgar Fausch and the TR-3B for troop transport and logistics. You know, does this secret space program have some sort of station across our solar system? I also want to remove this secret space program away from sort of the more Corey Good 20 and back type stories. Of course, some of these claims are quite fantastical, especially with Corey Good, the 20 and back story, which is essentially a story of indentured servitude to work side alongside extraterrestrials and humans in a space program. Corey Good, the manufacturer of this story, actually detailed these lies under oath. So let's separate from those, and we can take a much more grounded analysis to the secret space program. Part of it may be for nuclear superiority. In the secret space program talk, Mark talked that the Aurora craft was actually a part of this program, and the Aurora, you know, may have its place in this program due to the nuclear strike capabilities, as Brad described, and they could destroy any city in the Soviet Union with a population over 1 million in under 2 hours. So how interesting is this? The combination of Mark McCandlish's ARV with the entire testimony of Brad. Now that we have words from Brad's mouth, you know, forget the guise of death threats towards me telling me that to say goodbye to everybody I love, which, to be quite honest, I wouldn't get too hard on Brad about this. I think if anything, he's just probably trying to ward off amateur investigators off this case, because there is a real and present danger here. But being able to look at the story through Brad's words, you know, I can only think of two differences between Brad's and Mark's stories. One of these, in the secret space program talk, Mark spoke that the craft wasn't made of too much metal, that most of it was composite materials. In the interview with Brad, he mentioned that a lot of metal was used. So this may have just been something that evolved over time. You know, maybe Brad thought the filaments on the crew compartment and composite materials were in fact metal, and so forth. Also, Brad stated in the interview, there wasn't many stars, so general ships there, but this was in relation to the first interview with some of the terrestrial craft. He didn't actually specify if the generals were present for the ARV demonstration, that interview, which Mark said the three-star general was demonstrating the flight capabilities on the videotape. So, yeah, guys, we have the full story of ARV, and this is just one facet of ARV. We also have the full TR-3B investigation dating back to Edgar Fausch to go down. And then we have a whole array of vehicles purported to be using NHI technology to some extent, from artificial intelligence to full components and propulsion systems. And I think there's a total of 10 to 15 of these alleged craft. Of course, three of them being the Fluxliner, the Aurora craft, and the, my mind's skipping a blank here, the TR-3B. But we have plenty more to investigate with ARV. This isn't just McCandlish, but this story was made famous by McCandlish. So when Schellenberger mentions the story of ARV in the whistleblower report, I immediately think of these crude jello saucers with jaggedy flight dynamics that can travel faster than light speeds. Now, this is a very serious topic, guys. I don't want to draw any attention to Mark's grieving family, and of course James Allen's presumably still grieving family, but it was worth kind of highlighting the strangeness around these passings, especially Mark possibly being, you know, set to testify in June of 2021 before congressional and Senate elements. It begs the question, did Brad's protection of Mark, in whatever capacity, in whatever facet that was, run out when Mark decided to testify before Congress? Was it all fine and dandy for him to be running around with Greer and saying these things in documentaries and having fun, but as soon as it came time for him to be subpoenaed or to swear this under testimony, that was enough? I don't know, but so much respect to Mark. What a beautiful soul. During these past couple weeks, I've got to watch dozens, if not 50 plus hours of Mark speaking, and he truly was a great loss to humanity. What a beautiful artist. What a beautiful, eloquent person. And thank you, James Allen, again, for making such a beautiful documentary. With this episode, guys, I hope you enjoyed it. This was one of my favorite investigations ever to create. And with that being said, please remember to like and subscribe. I have a Patreon. I don't gatekeep any content there. Only support what you think the channel is worth. And guys, I will catch everybody on the next show
Oh, wait, real fast. I do plan to attend the November 13th hearings and the Soul Foundation, so I should have live coverage from those boots on the ground. But anyways, guys, with that being said, thank you so much for joining, and I will catch you all on the next show. Bye.